Money can buy you a good education, that is true, but the possession of money alone does not make you smart or wise or good-looking or funny or any of the things that other people find desirable. On the other hand, not having money can require you to develop some skills for getting along in life. A recent research project indicates that having less money can mean you develop a bit more wisdom over a life. The research work is laid out in a recent article in a research journal, and we have the lead researcher and co-author with us. That is Igor Grossman, a social psychologist at the University of Waterloo in Ontario. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
So the field is a wisdom research, which I haven't heard a great deal about. What's the general approach of the field?
Oh, it's a fairly diverse field. Some people study virtues, ideas. Others, like myself, we focus more on attitudes or reasoning strategies that help people to work through uncertainties that they face in life. So much more sort of pragmatic, practical wisdom.
So how people basically get through day-to-day life.
That's correct.
So what was the starting point for this particular piece of research?
Well, I've done some work previously in my lab where we looked at the situation where people are more likely to be flexible, to recognize limits of their knowledge, consider different perspectives on an issue. And we found that normally, well, surprisingly, when the situation focuses on you, when self-interest is involved, so to say, people are much less likely to engage in those strategies. And then there is another line of work that my lab has done, as well as many others, including California and Michigan, showing that typically people of low socioeconomic status, that is those who have low education and lower income on average, are less likely to focus on themselves and more likely to focus on their immediate environment. In other words, they're more interdependent than members of the middle class, and particularly in the U.S. So, like, we just tried to combine those two findings together. On the one hand, this kind of differences in wisdom by situation, if self-interest is involved or not, and then social class differences.
All right. It sounds exhausting, if not exhaustive. You put a lot of surveys out there, collected a lot of surveys, didn't you?
Yeah, well, I obviously had help from my wonderful graduate student, who is the first author on this project.
That's Justin Brienza?
That's correct.
Mm-hmm. So tell us what you did, what the methodology was for part one of the research.
So we did two studies. In one study, we just looked at asking a large group of people from the United States, from all over the country, to report on the most challenging conflict they experienced recently with somebody. Can be a conflict at the workplace, or it can be a conflict with a dispute with a spouse or with a friend. And we asked them to reflect on it and subsequently report on the extent to which they engaged in this reasoning strategy. So be it consider different viewpoints, consider how things may change, recognize that they may need to check for more information before forming some kind of a conclusion. And that sort of like was the first step. So in that first study, we just gave the surveys in which people reconstructed a particular conflict and then reported on their reasoning strategies. And we found that those people who were coming from less educated background or backgrounds with where they on average had lower income, fewer resources, economic resources, so to say, they were more likely to engage in this reasoning strategies when reflecting on their personal conflict.
A couple of questions here. Number one, used Amazon's Mechanical Turk, I understand, to get a hold of people for the surveys. What is that?
Amazon Mechanical Turk is a platform that is has been developed by Amazon, but it's basically a platform for people from all over the world. A lot of them are from the United States, who can complete simple tasks, surveys for psychological research, but most of the tasks are actually for marketing or for other companies online, so they can make a little bit of money by filling out a few questionnaires, for instance.
All right, so there's some incentive for people to get into this survey.
That's correct.
We're talking to Igor Grossman at the University of Waterloo in Ontario, Canada, west of Toronto, about his work called Social Class and Wise Reasoning about Interpersonal Conflicts Across Regions, Persons, and Situations, published in the Proceedings of the Royal Society B, Biological Sciences, with Justin Brienza as the lead author. You can join the conversation on the exchange. Have you felt like people who have less money have better reasoning skills or greater wisdom on some level? Let's get your thoughts on this. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So again, you asked people to talk about a recent conflict. Did it have to be a personal argument? Could it be political? Could it be over money? Did you constrain that at all?
In most cases, no, in the first study we didn't constrain it, but in most cases it was an interpersonal conflict. So it could have been about politics, or it could have been about money, but we did not have that restriction. We did that in the second study. So we did another study where the one that we did in the first, the approach we took in the first study was, of course, limited in many ways. It was just a survey, and people could have talked about whatever. So in the second study, we presented people with standardized situations involving intergroup conflicts or interpersonal conflicts. And the reason is we wanted to see, well, first of all, does this a tendency to reason in more sort of open-minded fashion, to recognize limits of one's knowledge, does it hold when you constrain the parameters, when you, for instance, present people just with issues that, so everybody reflects on the same issue? And secondly, does it extend to political discussion? And so what we found, and also, does it happen spontaneously? Do people spontaneously mention that instead of like presenting them and presenting people with a questionnaire? So what we did is like we gave people scenarios, actually took them from Dear Abby column in Washington Post.
Really, from Dear Abby itself, that column?
That's correct. We took the letters that were sent to the Dear Abby, not her responses, but the letters. And we asked people to just read the letter and tell us just openly, what do you think will happen after this letter? What exactly will be the next steps in the situation that is described in the letter? And we recorded their responses and looked at instances in which people say, well, you know, I actually don't know what will happen because it's not my situation. How can I know? This would be a sign of intellectual humility to some extent, or recognizing that your knowledge is limited. So like, you need to know more. You need to have more information about it. So things like that. So we had independent coders who went through participants' responses and coded them, and then we compared the responses again of people who had high education, who had who completed college, and those who did not. And what we found is that if you did not start college, if you just had a high school education, you were more likely to recognize that your knowledge is limited, to consider different viewpoints than if you had high school education. If you had college education.
So let me get this straight again. So you recognize the limits of your knowledge if your education stopped at high school?
That was one of the findings in the second study. That's correct.
Mm-hmm. How much did the survey work in the first study influence what you did in the second study?
Not much, because they were done approximately the same time. In fact, I would not say that, you know, like we designed the second study because of the results of the first one. They were just done in parallel. They had to complement each other.
Okay, so can you say from the surveys, before you even got to the Dear Abby questions in Ann Arbor, Michigan, what the general trend was that you noticed?
The trend there was also that people who were less educated, who had a lower income, or who were coming from states, actually, where the U.S. state had, on average, the median income of the state is lower. There are more people of blue-collar versus white-collar jobs, in those instances, people were more likely to recognize limits of their knowledge and consider uncertainty and change and consider different perspectives.
We're talking to Igor Grossman at the University of Waterloo in Ontario, Canada, about some research that he and Justin Brienza did to look at how social class corresponds with wise reasoning. So noticing that it looks like with lower education and lower income, people might actually gain a little more wisdom than people in higher educational and income brackets. We'll explore these in a little more depth in the moments ahead. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange with your thoughts, your questions, your comments, and maybe your experiences in this very line. 800-838-3760 to join by phone, by email. It's jx@jeffnet.org. So Dr. Grossman, are you drawing some inferences here that wrestling with life's challenges, especially if they're about money, might make you wiser?
That's correct. So the idea that we tried to explore in the project was to see if the ecology, the environment that you live in, particularly the socioeconomically constrained ecology, may force you to focus on others, to recognize that there is a great deal of uncertainty, and try to seek more information about it. And that, in turn, would force people who live in this particular ecological environment, who have, for instance, a more of a blue-collar background, to engage in the strategies, to be more intellectually humble, to take perspectives of people in the environment into consideration.
It seems like wisdom is a tough thing to wise reasoning anyway. But let's start there with wise reasoning rather than wisdom. And if there's a difference, you can explain that too. But when we talk about wise reasoning, what does that generally encompass?
So wise reasoning is a term that focuses on so-called intellectual virtues. So in philosophy, for instance, in epistemology or in epistemology of virtues, you feel like in order to understand the environment around you better, what are the virtuous qualities that the person should have? And such qualities include be intellectually humble, be more open-minded, consider a diverse set of perspectives, maybe even those that you don't like, and try to integrate them together. Wisdom was always sort of the epitome of this type of virtues at the end, and hence we call this type particular form of reasoning process that may be in your head when you think about a challenging situation as wise reasoning. So in essence, wise reasoning encompasses an intellectual humility, perspective-taking, openness to diverse viewpoints, and an attempt to integrate the different perspectives together.
You mentioned, too, that there's a fair amount of recognition if you don't have a lot of money or don't have a lot of answers that you're going to seek out help from other people, a greater recognition of interdependence. So conversely, I guess that means if you've got a little more money, if you've got a bachelor's degree or better, you think you might have some of the answers?
That is true. I mean, to some extent, it's also a cultural issue here. Certainly in North America, in Canada, and in the U.S., when you think about the mainstream culture of people who can afford things, the middle class, we think about what are the things that we teach kids at school. And we do not teach them to perspective take a lot. Instead of that, we teach them to be assertive, to focus on themselves, to focus on their achievements, to be independent, to be the leaders, to be the best, and so on. And all those tendencies, to some extent, go against this kind of interdependence orientation that you may need in order to engage in wise reasoning.
So where did a lot of your participants in either part one or part two of this research end up on income and education scales?
In part one, in the first study, we had a wide range of participants. A lot of people who would probably be considered rather poor or in the lower income brackets as compared to the rest of the country. We did not have many who I would classify as rich. I wish I had people who would be, let's say, in the top 25% of the distribution of wealth in the United States. But those people, of course, do not fill out psychological surveys or participate in psychological experiments on a regular basis. It would be very hard to get them into the lab. So that's one limitation. So, I mean, I can talk about middle class and the working class. I don't really cannot talk about the upper middle class and the rich. So in the second study, actually, we tried to go broad and try as much as we could to get a diverse set of population, diverse set of participants from Michigan. So I took an old school phone book and picked addresses from this phone book. Like, let's say the top address on each page, sent people letters. This was during the time when they still had a landline.
Right.
And then invited them to come into the lab. So they actually came into the building in Ann Arbor, Michigan. So there, we tried to target Ypsilanti and Ann Arbor. Ann Arbor is far, rather affluent because the University of Michigan is located there. Quite a number of white collar places to work at, whereas Ypsilanti is traditionally working class background. Like, that's where the former Ford factory was, as far as I remember.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, you're right about that. So no super rich, but no super poor either, I gather.
Yeah, I mean, like, that's correct.
Mm-hmm. All right. Igor Grossman, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking about social class and wisdom, the social class and wise reasoning about interpersonal conflicts across regions, persons, and situations. The title of his recent research with Justin Brienza. You can join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Here's a call from Carter in Wolf Creek. Welcome to the Exchange.
Yes, when I was traveling in India in the late 1970s, I learned of a wisdom there saying affluence dulls the sensibilities. And where I see that operating very strongly in our society today is a very large volume of what goes on in the Internet is in terms of information is dulling the sensibilities of people in a very wholesale way. And I would also indicate that there is a certain optimal flow of information through the life of a person, an individual, on a day-by-day basis that is optimal. And if you go beyond that, then you have dulled sensibilities. And if you go under that, you have a kind of a lostness of the person. And we do not understand these dynamics very well at all today in the society. And I very much appreciate the content of this particular part of the program.
All right. Thanks for that, Carter. Appreciate it. So we have a couple things to think about. Affluence dulling you just a bit, but also the idea that you can have too much information in your life. Igor Grossman, your thoughts on either of those?
Well, I think the first one, there is some research that goes beyond the paper that we're discussing here today that suggests that the affluence power, if you are in a more powerful position, as well as just economic affluence, does to some extent make you more self-focused and entitled. And certainly we can see that also on the level of societal trends. Some of the other work that I have done over the course of the last 150 years, if you look at national census data, if you look at big data from Google Books, the words that people have been using in books before the 20th century, the beginning of the 20th century, the end of the 20th century, and trying to track what are the kind of factors that contribute to shifts. Well, first of all, you see that people become more individualistic. They focus more on words like, in books, like unique, self-focused, achieved. And the second thing that we notice is that it is the general affluence, the societal affluence, that has been driving these factors to some extent, not only in the U.S. Most recently, we found that the same pattern in over 60 countries around the world, if you compare like national census from the various countries from the last 60 years. So there's definitely some support to this idea across various pieces of research. Do you want to interrupt?
I do. I was going to ask about of the two factors that we've talked about primarily, you know, the education and income, was either one a greater determiner of wise reasoning?
In this work, it's hard to say because we tried to use them together. Like in the second study in our research, we focused on education alone because unfortunately we did not collect the income data. But in the first study, we tried to combine them. The reason is because neither of them is a perfect marker of one social class. There's quite a lot of debate in sociology and political science about what would be the best marker of social class. So people have been doing research just on that question for over 50 years. And the consensus is that there are different ways to estimate it. Neither education nor income would be perfect. So in our work, we tried to put them together in a sort of like sophisticated statistical model where each of them would contribute to a mega factor of social class. So that's why it would be hard for me to say which of them contributes stronger. I think both of them are fairly equal.
Education and income. Okay, so if people in higher social classes read this study or about it and decide, well, you know, I probably need to work on my wise reasoning skills, how would they go about that?
Well, the other work that we have done suggests that one effective strategy for boosting your wisdom involves trying to mentalize yourself from a third person. So, for instance, instead of using your personal pronouns like I and me, what would I do? How would I approach this issue? One effective strategy has been to use third-person pronouns. What would Igor do? How would he approach this issue? What would be his thoughts? And so, like, talking about yourself in a third person. So sometimes that helps, this form of sort of self-distancing or ego-decenteriness, some researchers call it, seems to be boosting one's ability to reason wisely.
Igor, just a couple seconds left. What's the next logical step? Are you already working on next phases of this research?
Yeah, we try to manipulate one's power. We have a set of studies about that, as well as explore the role of adversity in general over time and how it impacts one's wisdom.
All right, some fascinating stuff looking at wise reasoning and wisdom and the fact that maybe if you're lower in social class, you actually possess more wisdom than people in higher social classes. This is the work of Igor Grossman and Justin Brienza at the University of Waterloo in Ontario. Igor, thanks for joining us today on The Exchange.